Session number 5201, Reel 2.
Wartime filming, Martin Gray, Reel 2. Were cameramen allotted to specific stories according to their aptitude for a particular type of event?
Yes, they were. Certain cameramen were obviously operated. One, they were better at doing sport. Two, because probably they liked it, therefore they're more interested. Others were given the jobs such as town hall work, parliamentary work, and this sort of thing, because they were better probably at putting a story together. And the others were, you could get somebody who was very good at putting a funny story together, and all newsreels like to have one funny story in an issue. And some had more fertile brains than others on this sort of thing. And I think it was a bit horses for courses. Obviously, everybody had to be able to do everything. And consequently, you didn't always find yourself doing sport, for argument's sake. You were probably doing something else. But you had to be able to do them all. But, of course, there were occasions when they said, well, he'll do it better than he will. We'll put him on it.
Who was Movietone's funny man?
Well, that, it could be quite several of them, as a matter of fact, because Paul was quite good at the funnies. He quite often used to act in them, being the big fat man that he was, and they used to dress him up as a little schoolboy. And Jack Ramsden was quite good at it. I don't know, everybody sort of pitched in. It was sort of a... It just depended on who thought of the idea, I think, more than anything else. But we used to great fun doing it sometimes. But the aces of this were not so much in Movietone; they were more in Paramount. Jimmy Gimmel was a past master at this sort of thing, and so was Arthur Farmer. And there were two of them. They used to come up with some beautiful gags. I can't think of anything offhand, but some of the things they used to come up with were quite funny. Oh yes, the one during the war they came up with. There was the spivs and so on, as they used to call them during the war, and then the fellow that came up, Arthur Farmer, he came up with a trilby hat right over one eye, and he says, I'm Arthur Moe, the spiv. What can I get you? You know, this sort of thing from peering round the corner. This sort of gag, and allied to a particular story in the newsroom, always used to cause a laugh in the cinema, and that's what everyone was trying to do.
What was your own forte?
Me? Sport when I was a cameraman.
At this stage, before the war, you were still linked with Leslie Murray.
I was Leslie Murray before the war, yes. And up to...
Was sport also his preferred?
No, not in those days. Leslie wasn't a great sporting man. He was a general, good all-round cameraman. He had a reputation which was very good of using long-focus lenses. And I mean, long-focus lenses in those days were... not so prevalent as they are now. And he was very good at this sort of deal, getting the big close-ups and this sort of thing, which, with the equipment that was being used, was quite a technical sort of job to get good close-ups of people and get them in the centre of the picture. Because nowadays you look through your film, through your lens, at what you're filming. In those days you had a separate viewfinder. And you had to judge with your viewfinder, if it was anything close, you had to judge how much of the picture what you got in the centre of the picture, but how much you had out of your frame on the viewfinder. But now, of course, it's so easy because you look straight through the lens.
Could you give a brief portrait of Leslie Murray, as he died recently and cannot be recorded otherwise?
He was I would say, a very good all-round cameraman, a man who, I didn't have a long time with him because of circumstances, wartime circumstances and everything else. But Leslie was very, very competent indeed, very conscientious, spent a lot of time with his equipment, keeping it up in order and so on. And I think he always got the best out of a story that was possible to get out of it, giving limited things one had as far as equipment and sometimes facilities and this sort of thing. I learnt an awful lot from him, I must admit. And, of course, he left the business. Of course, he left Movietone, and, of course, I didn't have a great deal of contact with him afterwards, but I've seen him from time to time, and the last time I saw him was probably a couple of years ago, I think. He always said, come down and see me at Fort Moore Magnum, but I never could get down there. It's always the way.
To return to your own career, on the outbreak of war, what did you do?
Outbreak of war, on the day war broke out, I was, as Rob Wilton would say, I was outside Buckingham Palace with Norman Fisher. And, yes, it wasn't, yes, Norman, yes. And the siren went off, and everybody, we saw everybody going across to the shelters, and we sort of filmed this. And said, we said, well, what do we do now? We'd better wait and see what happens. And, of course, nothing happened. The all clear went, and then we went, having filmed, and everybody coming out of the shelters again with their gas masks and so on. We then went back to the office. But other than that, after the outbreak of war, within, what, about a fortnight, I was in France for the BEF.
But before that, did you encounter any restrictions on photographing military subjects?
Well, I can't say whether I did or not, because I don't think we did very much of it at that point. I don't think so. No, I didn't come across any, personally. I know others did, but I didn't. I never, because I don't think basically I got involved in this sort of thing. Let's face it, it was only a fortnight between the outbreak of war and the fact that I was on my way to France, or near enough. And it took me most of my time to sort out the equipment we were taking with us and what spares I had to take, what batteries, additional batteries and all this sort of thing, and check all my equipment out, and also get kitted out with the uniform and so on, because we were given uniforms which were army uniforms, officer uniforms, which were the rank, honorary rank of captain, which was only for use if we were taken prisoner of war.
But you were supposed to be wearing it, didn't you?
Oh, we had to wear it all the time. Once out of the country, we didn't wear civilian clothes at all. Not in those days, you weren't allowed to. You had to stay in uniform all the time, be it battle dress or number ones, as the case may be. Anyway, as I say, we kitted out the car. We took our own car. We didn't have government transport at all. We took our own car, which was a Sunbeam Talbot 3-litre, and which we had sprayed khaki, because it was a black car. That it also, the army sprayed it for us and camouflaged it. And we fitted it up with the additional things, such as the additional dynamo to charge the batteries when we were running the car, and additional storage on it, as much as we could put, additional spare wheel and this sort of thing, and a place to put carry extra petrol, this sort of thing. Because we didn't know, really, at that time, what we were going to get involved in. I don't think anybody did. Anyway, we went over there, and we spent, until Germany invaded Poland and the Low Countries, we spent, from September through to May
in Arras. The we, Jack Cotter.
Now, I went with Jack Cotter to start with, and Jack eventually got something wrong with his ankles and he couldn't walk. And then I teamed up with Norman Fisher till after we got back to this country after being thrown out of France. Jack was there probably about 4 or 5 months, or maybe 6. And he and I did all sorts of things, Gracie Fields and concerts, you know, to the troops and what they were doing and so on. And because at that time it was all very, it wasn't wartime stuff at all, really. It was all peacetime stuff in France. And we spent most of our time sort of showing everybody what the boys were doing in France. Digging trenches and this sort of, well, everything that with army life. And then, of course, Jack, you know, we had the famous occasion when the King came over, and Jack at that time was laid up with his ankles. And Norman was with the RAF, and we had other cameramen there. We weren't the only ones, but we were the only ones with the sound unit. We were the only ones throughout the war as war correspondents, as a newsroom outfit, who had a recording unit abroad anywhere. And when the King was due to come, Jack said to me, well, we'd only got four cameramen out there, I think it was, but we needed more. And Jack said, well, you better go down to Boulogne and film his stepping off the boat onto the French soil. I said, all right, Jack, I'll try. Don't expect anything very beautiful, because at that time I hadn't turned a camera. It was the first time I ever turned a camera over in my life. So I went down with Stanley Kessel at the Times, and Times still photographer, and I said to Stanley, now, before you do anything else, just before he gets off the boat, I want what stuff I've got to use. I've no idea. He said, all right, I'll tell you. Because in those days they had a blind shutter blind on their steel camera. But he'd also had some, I forget whether he had a meter or something. But anyway, just before, as the ships started to come in, or turn the corner, I'd come in up the harbour. He said, I forget where he was. I think he said, F8. I said, right. Set all my lenses and focus them up. And I did the King arriving and getting off the boat, and also inspecting the troops, guard of honour and what have you. I never did see the pictures. So I believe they were all right, but I never saw them. That was the first time I ever turned a camera. And I don't think I did it again until after the war.
When you were in France, were you always accompanied by a conducting officer?
Yes and no. A conducting officer should have been with us all the time, but some of the time we used to go on our own.
Were they helpful?
Yes, basically yes. As helpful as they could be under the circumstances. You must remember that it was all a new thing, and they were there. They didn't know what it was all about. They were all rookies. They had to learn what, or the conducting officer, what he was and so on, what he should do and so on. And a lot of it, I think, they eventually learnt from us, from the war correspondents. And eventually they were quite good. But, of course, at the early part, I mean, it was all a bit frustrating. They didn't know quite what it was all about, and we didn't know how to approach it. And, of course, with the army resistance to the press generally, it was a little bit, right in the early stages, a bit like pushing against a brick wall, which you usually got through in the end. But once they realised that we, as film people, were there to publicise them, to help them and to put across the fact what they were doing and so on, they became very cooperative.
Can you recall any precise instance when the facilities accorded you were not what you would have wished?
No, I can't, because usually it was such pinprick stuff that You sort of said, oh, it's not worth it, let's not bother. Yeah, never did we come across at any time any difficulty in France. They probably had more difficulty in this country than they had in France. It wasn't so much a difficulty as the lack of cohesion between the press department and the army. I don't think it was anti as far as the army were concerned, because it was very soon and very quickly that you could get anything you wanted. But it was just the fact that the conducting officers didn't know how to go about it.
Were all the British war correspondents, newsreel, cameramen included, all living together at Arras?
Yes. We had our own mess in the Strasbourg Hotel in Arras. We had the back room, which was our mess headquarters, and where everybody came to where they knew they could find us. And we had our own headquarters as well in the main, the main hotel in the high street. That was the headquarters of the whole outfit, but our own particular one was in this one. We started it up ourselves, matter of fact, but it was basically for the newsreel men and the press photographers and the photographers, including one or two of the army photographers as well, who were attached to the headquarters.
Can you recall Harry Rignold? Who was
very
there?
Well, Captain Harry Rignold, yes, very well indeed. Very great friend of mine. Oh, yes. Harry was a movie cameraman. Yes, Harry, Len Putnam. Oh, dear. Can't remember them all offhand now. And a lot of them. A man called Davis, who was a Portland General man originally. He was an official War Office photographer. And, of course, at that time, we also had the Air Communications Squadron with us, which were made up of all the old pilots from Croydon Aerodrome. We used to fly the Dragon Rapides from Croydon. They used to take us flying on aerial pictures before the war. And Jack Cotter's pilot, Bill Ledley, can't think of his name, but he was there. And so we had all this lot that used to come in all the time. They were doing all the communications, headquarters communications, ferrying back and forth to London, and they were with us in the mess as well.
How was your film ferried back to London?
By these people, by these Dragon Rapides. The Air Communications Squadron did all the ferrying for us. We had to have censors who used to have to censor our copy, if you like, the copy that the reporters did, and also our dope sheets that we sent back with the film. But of course the film was censored in London because it was developed in London. But they used to censor the our dope sheets out there just to make sure that we hadn't said anything outrageous in it. They knew very well that basically the pictures would be either used or not used according to censorship in London. But the censorship really was more for the reporters than the photographers. Because the photographers themselves had their own lab out there. They used to develop all their prints out there and check them, get them all censored and passed before they sent them back to London. But we had to do it the other way because there wasn't any means of developing our film.
Did you have any contact at all with your French cameraman colleagues?
No. They were all with French forces, and we never got tied up with them. Well, yes, we met them in Paris when we used to go down to Paris occasionally, because the Movietone office was still operating in Paris, and we would meet them in Paris, but not in the field. No.
Did you film the French army?
No. We were purely interested in the British army. We weren't interested in anybody else. We were all right when the balloon went up. Yes, we got a bit involved with the Belgians and so on, but not to any degree.
Can you recall filming General Gort?
Yes, we had to do an interview with General Gort in his office, and he was very cooperative, very helpful indeed. And we had to more or less tell him what to say. We asked him what he wanted to say. I can't remember what it was about now, but asked him what he wanted to say, and he started to say it. And we said, well, excuse me, just a moment. You're being a little fulsome in what you're saying. Can you sort of make it a little more concise? Because we have only time for 2 minutes on the screen. And this was the problem all the time, that you had to tell any of them, that you had to get them down to say what they wanted to say in a nice, concise, short statement. And I can't remember what it was. I think it was something to the effect. I've got a feeling it was Christmas message to all the families at home from all the troops in the BEF, I think. And, of course, we did do a lot of... we didn't do much of it in the BEF days. We did just a little bit of it, of the odd troops talking to the camera about what they were doing, but not messages home. That came later on. But not on the BEF days. It was more saying what they were doing and what life was like.
You mentioned how you had to restrict your interviews to 2 minutes. Did you ever consider that with a longer interview it could be edited back at the office?
Yes, you can do, but you see, the thing is this, we didn't restrict quite so much. It depended on what the office asked us for. If they said we want an interview with, we want a Christmas message from General Gort, but it mustn't be longer than a minute, because it's in context with a whole lot of other things, from a whole lot of other theatres or other bits and pieces, other units or whatever it is, and the rest. And his little bit, and the BEF little bit of Christmas, whatever it may be, had to fit into a slot. Therefore, you had to do what they asked within. All right, I mean, nobody's going to argue about 10 or 15 seconds, but as long as it didn't run over a long way. And this is, I think it was the thing that we got so used to doing that we used to do this automatically.
Did you receive many requests from the office for specific material?
Oh, yes, quite often, yes. Yes, but whether you could give it to them or not was another matter. You were always asked for a specific material, not necessarily from your office, but quite often for general, for everybody. Because you bear in mind, you see, in these days, that we were all operating together as a unit. All the newsreels were together. All the film was pooled between all the companies, and all the cameramen were all part of one pool. And all the film went back to London and was distributed to all the newsreels. They took what they wanted. They weren't at liberty to take that every bit of film that came back, but they used to take what they wanted. And they used to sit in the Central Office of Information, or the Ministry of Information as it was in those days, and say what they would have and what they wouldn't have.
Did you ever receive bonuses for particularly good bits of film?
No.
Either before the war or during?
No. I can't recall any. Not in the newsreel side of it. I believe it did go on, but not in movie time. I think it went on in some of the other companies, but not certainly in ours. No, the wartime was, certainly France, was what we call the phony war, and it was the phony war, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you used to go out and laughably, you think about it now, you were out what you would call the frontline troops, dug in, you know. And it was the biggest laugh imaginable, thinking of it now. But at the time, you thought it was great stuff. But, I mean, of course, it was a wicked winter as well. We had outside our hotel, and one day we decided we'd find out how much ice we had on the road. We got hold of one of these great big iron spikes and dug down. We had 2 feet of ice on the road.
Did this affect your cameras?
Yes, it affected the cameras, it affected the cars and everything. We had to keep them as warm as we could and keep our batteries well up. This is more to the point. As long as you kept your batteries well charged and gave them enough urge to turn the camera over at the right speed, because all the cameras were controlled by a regulator, which controlled the actual speed of it. It was a governor. It was called a Creed governor, but this controlled the speed of the camera, but you needed a good battery to make it turn over. And of course, our problem was with the cars. More than anything else, we had 50 cars in the pool, of which 48 were army, and the BBC and ourselves had 2 private cars. The BBC had a Wolseley and we had the Sunbeam Talbot. And it was such that the antifreeze in those days wasn't that brilliant. But we had to just drain the antifreeze out of the cars every night because it froze. And we used to have put it in petrol tins, then put it on a Valor stove to warm it up in the morning, put it back in the car, and it was the first car started, it had to tow somebody else to start everybody else. And BBC and Harvey Sarney and I, we used to vie with one another who could manage to start the car first. You couldn't use a starter. You had to use a handle on them. People wouldn't understand this nowadays. You had to handle it with a crank. Your starter wouldn't turn it over.
To move on now to the German attack on France, the public relations side was in a degree of some confusion then, I believe.
Yes, there was a lot of confusion about it because when the attack came, they moved up to Lille. And we came back one night, we'd been out somewhere, we didn't even know that the attack was underway, we'd been somewhere, and we came back, and of course headquarters had all moved up to Lille, and there was only a skeleton staff in the headquarters in Arras. So we dashed up to Lille, grabbed all our things and went up to Lille, and we operated out of Lille for, oh, I don't know, what was it, 3 or 4 days, I suppose. And we went up, and I was out with somebody else. Norman went up with his own camera with somebody else. And I never really did connect up with Norman until we got back to Boulogne. Because I was out with a still photographer. I was doing a bit of sound somewhere. I forget what it was I was doing. And there'd been a request from London for some sound of some sort. I can't remember. Wild track, yes. And I'd been out with Leslie Davis, the still photographer. He'd come out with me because he wanted some shots where I was going, so we went out together. And of course, when we came back, everybody had gone up to Lille, and when we got to Lille, there was nobody in Lille except the public relations officers, and they didn't really know what was going on. And so Leslie and I just stayed together, because, I mean, Leslie had no transport, now everybody left him, and I hadn't got a cameraman because I didn't know where he was. Nobody seemed to know where he was anyway. This is not his fault any more than mine. It just so happened the circumstances were such. And we just went out together. I drove him around and did a bit of recording of German planes going over the top of us. And of course, we went out and we got as far as Louvain. And we came back that night, and the road had all been blitzed. Tournai was blitzed, and everything was lying around everywhere.